From the Sky News Centre at 5, UKIP claims more members of Parliament could defect to the party after they won the Rochester and Strood by-election. Tim Jones reports.
I swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance.
Mark Reckless takes his oath in the House of Commons hours after becoming UKIP's second elected MP. The former Conservative won back his seat this morning. Ed Miliband thinks it's a humiliation for the Prime Minister.
He assured us he was going to win.
David Cameron's trying to stay upbeat.
This result was closer than the forecasters predicted.
But UKIP leader Nigel Farage thinks this is the start of a trend.
I would be very surprised if there weren't more defections.
And he says they could come from Labour as well as the Tories.
Meanwhile, Ed Miliband says it's right his now former Shadow Attorney General has stepped down from the role over a tweet she sent which was criticised as snobbish. Emily Thornberry posted a message including a photo of a house draped in several flags of St George with a white van on the driveway. Two people believed to be removal men have died in a balcony collapse in central London. The incident in Knightsbridge injured six others. They're thought to have been moving a sofa at the time. Abel de Moussey lives close to the house where it happened.
I heard a lot of commotion early in the morning, and when I came out I saw that there was ropes dangling from the remainder of the balcony. And apparently there was people trying to move furniture.
Three teenagers have been arrested by police in the West Midlands following a series of robberies yesterday allegedly involving guns. Officers recovered two weapons following three incidents in Tipton. The boys, aged 14, 15 and 18, are being questioned. A co-chairman at Sheffield United says he's frustrated the club's retracted an offer to let convicted rapist Ched Evans train there again. The Professional Footballers Association's also said it hopes he'll be given another opportunity at a different club. And Bill Cosby's cancelled a show in Las Vegas following his historical allegations over the US comic's behaviour against women. His lawyer has denied the claims against him. That's the latest. I'm Tom Harrigan.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for Clifton East and the chair of Place Scrutiny, Christian Martin. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, award-winning journalist and TV documentary producer Tim Tate, who lives here in the West Country, in the early 1990s he made an hour-long documentary, Conspiracy of Silence, for the Discovery Channel, which was never shown. It was about a care home, child prostitution and drug-running ring with collusion by the FBI at the very top of the Republican Party in Nebraska and Washington. This week he gives us his diagnosis on the death of British TV investigative journalism. Lockerbie, we heard a few weeks ago from father of one of the victims, Jim Swire. The Lockerbie bomb certainly wasn't loaded up in Malta, and a break-in, which was kept secret at Heathrow, suggests the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 might have been the work of the Western Security Services. Also, French Hay Hospital, a community hospital, was promised on the old site, which is now being developed for luxury homes. Barbara Harris is here with South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group's Daphne Havercroft to tell us whether it's actually going to happen. That's Martin Summers' tour of the world, hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 degrees Celsius and showers. This weekend, highs of 13. A cloudy weekend with lots of showers. Next week, highs of 10, sunshine and more showers. And next weekend, that's the 29th and 30th of November, highs of 7 degrees Celsius, but few, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for Clifton East, chair of Place Scrutiny, that's Christian Martin. Hi, Christian. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, good evening, Tony.
First of all, your job as chair of Place Scrutiny. Tell us how you got that, first of all, and then secondly, what do you have to do?
Right, well, I got it because internally within our group, we elected me to take the chairmanship of the commission, and what we do in the commission is we look at what was formerly the sustainable development and transport aspects of council policy. So that includes everything from the arena to Green Capital to the Metro bus to BRT to the harbour, the port, all sorts of things like that. Air quality, flooding.
Okay, so you mentioned the arena. This is a bit of a contentious topic, certainly because, you know, it's not just the Lib Dem groups, but many people across the city council's political parties seem to be worried about the figures, whether the figures are actually, you know, it's not just the figures, but it's also the entire plan for the arena, whether George Ferguson is being open enough with actually making a case for the arena. Now, it might be a pure, well, it probably is pure coincidence, but I know that George is implementing cuts of £90 million over 3 years. Now, it just so happens that's the same as the cost of the arena. So do we really need this arena? And how much have you been able to find out about how much it's going to cost and whether it's going to be really good for the city in the long term? With the thought that possibly we may be paying off loans to build this thing for decades into the future.
Well, I mean, you highlight precisely what some of the councillors, including myself, have been questioning of the mayor at the council. However, we were put under an exempt order to not be able to talk about certain aspects of the arena during an OSM, which is the Overview and Scrutiny Management Board meeting last week, after they had removed the arena scrutiny from my commission. And I have a strong sense that the reason it was removed from my commission was because I'd been rather robust with the mayor when I called him to account on residence parking. So I can tell you that the money that we are going to be borrowing, and everybody here in the city needs to understand, this is going to be a mortgage around our necks of tens of millions of pounds, which are intended to be paid back through the rents that they charge the operators for using the arena, but secondly, against future revenues coming from the uptake in businesses in the enterprise zone. If none of that comes to pass, you and I will be paying off that debt for years to come.
Well, for how long?
Well, currently it's a 25-year loan. So if it keeps going up and up and up, which we suspect it will, the cost of the arena, it could be much longer than that, that it takes us to actually pay it all off. From what I understand from what we saw last week, and I think I'm okay in saying this, but hell, you know what? They're gonna have me under the code of conduct if I'm wrong anyway. But one of the things that they said to us last week was the fact that they intended after 25 years that we would probably make a profit on it. But the profit is so minimal that it really begs the question, can we afford it? When we were trying to do it at 30 million quid, we couldn't get the business case to stack up. His is costing over 110 million at the moment, and he's getting it to stack up.
That's so another 20 million.
Yeah, we've not even seen the business case that proves that it works. So
this is pretty shocking stuff, Christian, actually, because most annoys me is not necessarily that this has been taken out of your portfolio, because you've been asking some very awkward, difficult questions about it quite clearly, but that you've been told you can't talk about certain things. What was said and by whom? And have you been served with some sort of an injunction or what exactly?
We have a new monitoring officer at the council, and it seems to be his modus operandi that ahead of every single meeting we are now challenged, or certainly I face the challenge of having to run various legal loopholes on what it is that we are and are not allowed to discuss publicly. So we get notification in the form of a reference to the Localism Act and the Local Government Act, and it specifies in there why we can and cannot discuss certain things publicly. We've never seen this before. You know, it's never happened before. That's why we all issued a cross-party press release last week about the gagging on all of this.
So how much support have you managed to get against this legal restriction on what you are and are not allowed to say from other parties then?
Well, as I said, press release went out last week, cross-party support on the issue of the fact that we were being gagged over the arena. I mean, let's be honest here. A lot of us would love to have an arena here in Bristol, and that is our aspiration. But the question remains, is it affordable? We have other issues. We need housing. We need to sort out the transport in the city. We need to sort out a whole range of other things. Is it the be-all and end-all that's going to solve all of our problems? I'm not sure that it is. I'd like one. I'd like to go to a pop concert in the centre of the city. But is it even in the right place? That's another question that needs to be asked. But we've never been allowed to scrutinise that question because there were no options given to us to explore.
Okay, so yes, you're right. Most people would like to see an arena, but you're quite nervous about whether the figures are stacking up. How much do you know about the figures, and what have you not been told?
I know how much we have been offered from two different bidders to operate the arena. And I can't reveal the amounts of money, but I can tell you that one is easily Well, I can't say. No, I can't say. A hell of a lot more than the other one. But it does seem to fit the arguments that the officers are making, that we can force this square peg through a round hole and produce an arena without, you know, without too much financial risk to the city. The point is, the financial risk does exist.
Well, one of the things we've seen regularly in the privatisation of things which local government are involved in is that companies put in a very low bid. I mean, we saw this with some of the train operating companies, for example. They put in a very low bid, they win the bid, and then when it actually comes to it, after a couple of years, the whole thing falters because they put in a low bid to get the business, and then they can't deliver.
But what I have to tell you is that they... Originally, a lot of the revenue that would be coming in to service the loan was predicated on parking fees. There is no parking required anymore to bring in revenue for the arena. That's apparently what we were told last week. I think I'm allowed to say that. There is also no parking provision. Now, that is an area, the travel plan and the transport plans and the parking arrangements for the arena should be scrutinised by my committee, but it has not been allowed. And in fact, yesterday I had a meeting where I again insisted it comes back for us to have a look at, but it's not been allowed. You know, where are people going to park?
Well, that's a good question, particularly with something as important as this. So how much are the council being asked to put into it in terms of from the council's annual spend into the building of the arena and then also in loans that the council will be responsible for?
Well, I mean, I can tell you from the back of an envelope calculation from the figures last week that we were told, including contingency, etc., I've calculated it's over £110 million. However, the drawdown on that to build it, I'm not sure because we weren't given those figures. We will obviously be borrowing against the rent that the operator will be providing us with over those 25 years. So all the risk is up front and loaded on us as the taxpayer.
Doesn't sound very acceptable. So what do you think is going to happen here? Are we going to get an arena or not, Christian?
I hope we get an arena, but I just think a little bit more transparency so that we are all satisfied and reassured that we can afford to do this would be sensible, and also that we can park somewhere and our visitors to the city can park somewhere to go and enjoy the entertainment.
I suppose another aspect of all this is how upfront has George Ferguson been, the mayor? Has he been coming along to scrutiny? Has he been making sure, if he can't make it, that officers are there, his officers, to answer these questions? Because what you're doing actually is extremely important. I hope you don't mind me saying it is extremely important that we have somebody there who's looking, taking the long-term view, saying, well, look, does the city want to be paying for this in 10 years, 20 years' time still? And if so, can we afford it? These are really important questions that aren't often being asked by central government, who are getting into all sorts of ridiculous amounts of unpayable debt, for example, through the bailout of the banks in 2008, that they're never going to be able to pay back. We want to make sure, at least in Bristol, that we can balance the books in a few years' time.
Absolutely. And the problem that I foresee at the moment is that we don't know whether we're going... Recession's becoming cyclical. You know, you can't predict when they're going to happen, but they're happening. And in all the figures that I saw, there seemed to be no provision for that. You know, there seems to be no provision for a downturn. There seems to be no provision for a hiccup. And when that happens, if we've already committed a huge amount of money to proceed with this arena, we are in the shtum. You know, we are stuck with a debt and we have to make the choice. Do we carry on or do we just write it off? That's a big ask.
What exactly are the reasons being given then for telling you that there are certain things you can't talk about? And if you do, I imagine you may be sanctioned as a councillor, you may lose your job as a councillor, you may be told, well, you're going to have a by-election or something, you know, that extreme. You certainly may have to go through a whole procedure to defend what you've said. So what reasons exactly have been given for gagging you?
Well, more often than not, the reasons that are given are based on commercial sensitivity. And because of the fact that officers will argue that they're in a precarious or sensitive period of negotiation. I mean, what became apparent in the meeting last week is that that's all well and good, and we appreciate and to some degree respect that sensitivity. But when you then discover in these meetings that they haven't even concluded the negotiations on some of these things, you do sit there and wonder, well, what the hell are we scrutinising?
Okay, fascinating. Anyway, just a little heads up, financial... criminals in Bristol. Could we have financial criminals in Bristol? This is I got a tip the wink about this, that there's going to be a BBC panorama on Monday where some of Bristol's financial institutions are going to be featuring, and not necessarily in a very good light. So that will certainly be interesting. On the political side, we have what I call my city slackers. We have them, usually I announce them in February, or February or March, if we're going to have an election in May. People who I've regularly contacted to try and get them on this programme to talk about their views, give us a sort of, basically so the voters can get to know them. And there are a few people that really don't want to, it seems, respond to my invitations. I don't mind if they want to come back and give me a good reason, or, you know, say, well, actually, I'm looking after kids on a Friday this time. Absolutely fine. But there are some who don't. And one of them, Christian, is your fellow Clifton East councillor, Simon Cook. Now, he's an actor, I think, at least in the past when I knew him on the Cultural Development Partnership, he was. And he's the Lib Dems' main man on Ferguson's cabinet. He only squeaked in by a few votes when he was re-elected. I think it was
17.
17 votes. But he won't reply to my calls or come in this show. Is he a busy man? Because it's rare for an actor to be so shy.
I can't possibly answer for Simon. I do know, though, that, you know, he's had family matters of late to deal with that have distracted him. I think his post on the cabinet keeps him busy.
It would be interesting to get his view, you know, on this, particularly because he's a sort of halfway house on this arena issue between the mayor and yourself. And so if you can twist his arm and get him on the radio, it'd be really interesting to hear from him. Another one of the city slackers, probably worse than Simon, because Simon did come on once about 3 years or 4 years ago, is John Galandris. He's concentrating on his share prices when he should be paying attention at council meetings, apparently. What I keep hearing is he's always on his smartphone looking at the price of the latest shares, and he looks up and, oh, is someone asking me a question? And he works for the bankers Coutts. That's the bankers to the royal family. He's a bit of a man of mystery. Tell us, what do you know about John Galandris? What kind of chap is he?
I will be absolutely fair to John and say that at the scrutiny meeting on the arena last Friday, he was incredibly robust on trying to understand exactly what the guarantees were. So his expertise from banking was put in place and utilised. He was trying to hone down and drill down onto exactly what the guarantees were that we were getting from this potential new company that's going to operate, or is the preferred bidder potentially. We don't know because the mayor hasn't made his decision yet at cabinet. I'm covering my back here because I might be giving away too much. But he was great at putting the officers on the spot, and they actually didn't have the answers, which I thought was very revealing. There was an expert. They couldn't answer the expert.
Well, that's why it's so useful to have experts like that around, isn't it? Okay, so...
And if it had been out in the public would have noticed... You know, and that's the thing. John's hardworking. I like John.
Yeah. So why do you think it is he's so shy? He doesn't want to come on the radio and talk to us over, we've been running this show for about 4 years or so now.
Well, it's funny because he's the whip, you know, for the Tories. So he's not backwards in coming forwards.
What's his view on the arena? Does he give a view on that?
I think he shares the concern over the affordability.
Mm. Okay, now just looking at more generally at the City Council, we've got an annual budget. I think it's about £370 million that you guys are responsible for of our money. So we're always looking to see how you're spending it. Where George is implementing the 90 million cuts. Do you think he's made the case for Bristol actually having as few cuts as possible at the highest levels, that is to say central government, that sort of thing? You know, I'm not sure whether that's, you think that's part of his job, but I would hope that if he's up at central government, he's saying, well, hang on a minute, Bristol doesn't want to make 90 million of cuts, but I haven't really heard that from him.
Well, let's not forget, the promise that was made was that if we got a mayor, they would have more opportunity to lobby for better, greater and more important things for Bristol. What has George gone and got from government for this city, other than his own imposed cuts on us? And he argues that it's the coalition that's imposed the cuts, but that's not necessarily true, because if you remember at the budget last year, we, the Liberal Democrats, were actually arguing that there was a lot more money swilling around in the coffers than they were making out, and that the cuts didn't need to be deep and as wide as he was intending them to be. We, you know, portended that this was actually because he wanted to bring in the revenue to pay for his big project, which is the arena, etc., etc., and to balance the books on that. And sure enough, there's 14 million recently gone over into reserves on top of the reserves that they put across last year. There's 3.9 million that he's announced that we suddenly got a slush on from the tax take. you know, which we also said was going to happen. We could have frozen the council tax. That could have helped people on low incomes and struggling families across the city by saving them a few quid every single week. But he chose not to do that. He could have got money from the government as a consequence of freezing the council tax. You know, there are some very hard questions that he's got to answer about the way he's gone about doing these things. But of course, we're not allowed to do that because we're then accused of playing politics. The truth of the matter is, we're there to do exactly what he says that he is doing for the city, is to look out for all of our citizens and to do what's best for the city.
So I'm taking it that you're not really that impressed with the way that the whole mayoral system is coming through. Because one of the things I can remember right from when the first vote took place about whether we were going to have a mayor or not, never mind George or who was going to be the mayor, but at that vote was that the vote was made and then the vote ballot boxes were taken to Bristol City Football Ground and kept overnight. And I asked around at the City Council on this, and there was no CCTV coverage of these ballot boxes. And then they were opened at 10 o'clock in the morning. So I don't think that's really a very good way to hold a secure democratic referendum on whether we want a mayor or not. But besides whether or not that was a proper free and fair election, how do you think it's gone with George?
I think it's actually been a real struggle, and I think that, you know, he has a certain number of apparatchiks and disciples that are constantly out there supporting him, either as trolls or as commentators.
You mean on the internet?
Yeah, on the internet, on Facebook.
Screen names. Do you want to name any screen names that might be George's trolls?
No, I don't. I can't remember off the top of my head. But there you go. Clifton Wood RPZ. I mean, that's a classic one. You know, constantly supporting everything that he's doing. The bottom line is that I don't think he has been as successful as he would like to have been, because a lot of what he is actually following through on is policy that was already in train. This is a man that came in with no policies. He came in with a lot of hot air and generalisations, which made everybody feel cuddly and bubbly with the expectation it was going to change politics here in the city.
Well, that's not fair,
is it? It hasn't changed anything.
He did say that people have been messing around, like your party, for years, talking about residence parking, and that he was going to actually do it, and that's exactly what he's done.
No. We proposed to residents that they could have a consensual schemes designed by them. He came in and said, I'm going to impose it. And the interesting thing about residence parking zones is, finally, after 18 months, I recently got the data on exactly how many cars the council's monitoring and data collection agencies discovered were commuter cars. And in most of the residence parking zones, it was less than 25% of the cars during the day were commuter cars. Now, that doesn't add up to me to an argument for imposing residence parking, but I think he could have done it consensually, like we proposed and like we did.
Okay. Overall, though, some people are saying, well, Bristol's now kind of Bristol PLC, and actually the city councillors, like yourself, don't have any power. George has got it all.
No, George would like you to think that we don't have any power. George would like you to think that we're supernumeraries. That is not the case. We are out there every day in our constituencies, our wards rather. We are also in committees, scrutiny sessions, meetings, briefings, trying to unearth, discover, keep an eye on, correct, check what's happening at the council. We have a hell of a... In fact, I can tell you, Place Scrutiny used to meet six times previously. We now meet every single month. And in that month, I probably have four meetings just before we even get to the Place Scrutiny. So the workload has increased exponentially under the mayoral system.
What about just general relations with the mayor? Do you think it's you were saying earlier you're accused of playing politics? I mean, surely that's what running a city is about.
Well, it is, but the trouble is, it's all about George. That the entire mayoralty is about George, and that's there's the problem. He is a political party. He is an individual who has set up a political party to run this city, but he has no members elected to support him at the council. So he has to pool his support from a rainbow cabinet of what I've referred to as nodding donkeys, because they actually have no responsibility. And that, I think, is problematic for democracy in the city because he has seized all the power. He's making all the decisions. But outwardly, he is telling everybody that we're all making the decisions.
Well, we had the Green Party's Gus Hoyt, who's on the cabinet here last week, and he was saying, actually, my role is quite important as an advisor to George. What I'm doing is I'm passing, basically, the feelings of people in his ward, which is Ashley Ward in St Paul's area, onto George, and also from the Green Party onto George. So George is listening. He doesn't necessarily do what Gus says.
And there's the rub on the transparency that I'm talking about, because what George likes to do is he likes to have one-on-one private meetings with councillors that you nor I ever hear anything about. There's no record of them. There's no transparency as a consequence. So Gus Hoyt can sit there and tell you that, but I live in Ashley Ward, and I can tell you it paints a much different story to the one that he's painting, because if he's passing on the problems of Ashley to George, I'd love to know exactly what headway he's making, because I see none on the street.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, there's been a big change in the city with the mayoral system. Is it working?
Well, I hear everything that's being said. I was one of those that was against having a mayor, and therefore I'm sceptical. Once you've got a mayor, we're in a position where we've got to try and make this system work. I mean, I was actually probably marginally against the Labour Party going into the coalition, into the cabinet, but I was largely overruled, I think. Probably rightly. I think people felt that, you know, we could have just stood on the sidelines and criticised, but that wouldn't have actually been very constructive. And so I kind of bowed to the majority there. But I think the problems are obvious, aren't they? When you've got, just one source of power, he's got no real political support. He's got one councillor that was elected on the Independence for Bristol ticket.
See him around.
Yes, but the point is, it's not enough to form a coalition, is it? So, you know, he's inevitably forced to be a kind of constitutional monarch or unconstitutional monarch, because he hasn't got the discipline of belonging to a political group. And this is the problem with celebrity politics, isn't it?
Christian, does it feel like a feudal system?
Well, I could. I mean, I keep referring to it as the Louis the who was it, the Sun King, let them eat cake.
Louis the 14th,
exactly. Because and I'm sorry to be personal, Gus, but I sometimes look at him and I think he is the court joker. He has the ear of George, and George cozies up to him. And you have to ask yourself the question: what is that symbiotic relationship all about? We don't know what's going on. We don't know what's... I mean, they're taking all the credit for the Green Capital, and yet the Green Capital was started under Labour and the Liberal Democrats, and everything that's coming through next year is as a result of that.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. Did the Greens sign up to this scrutiny about the arena?
Tim was there, yes.
It is cross-party.
Yes, it was cross-party. They did not sign up to the press release, the joint press release that was cross-party.
That's what I thought.
They excluded themselves from that. They didn't want to be involved in it.
Yeah, so it sounds like they are seeing themselves as closer to George than anybody else, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think they're a party of yes people, because actually... The Greens, present themselves as this cuddly, bubbly party, that where everything is positive and everything is nice. If you peel away the surface of the environmental issues that actually other parties, including my own, have been advocating and pioneering for years, underneath is what I consider to be quite an anarchic layer of horrendously dictatorial and authoritarian policies.
But actually, most parties are like that. You get to the centre, even your own, Christian, when you get towards the centre, particularly when, obviously the Bristol Greens see themselves as a big force for the future. They're concentrating hard on getting things right, and they've got to have a disciplined party.
Now, it's not authoritarian towards their members. I'm talking about what they would do if they were actually in power, the authoritarian dictatorial route that they would take. I mean, I was at the TTIP debate the other week, which was a Green organised event, so it was 99% of the room Greens, etc., and sympathisers to the...
It was Friends of the Earth.
Was 99% Greens, and it was, sympathetic to the fear-mongering and the closed minds that they had on the debate. But the point being that you had Molly, who's their MEP, who was basically suggesting that, we should all curb our consumerism, which obviously would have an impact on our economy, because she actually is quite happy to have one pair of shoes. Well, that all sounds very nice and bubbly, but in truth, what she's trying to say to you is, I'm going to take away your choice. You should only have one pair of shoes.
But I mean, there's a much more to TTIP than that, isn't there? I don't think there's any. I mean, we had a good discussion about it last week, and there are certain aspects to it which would actually make voting pointless, where you vote for a government to do something, and then big corporations can take that government to court and say, no, you can't do it.
Ask Molly, ask Gus, ask any Green councillor or politician which government has lost against a company suing. Any company that sues a government has never lost. The government's never lost. It never loses any of these cases.
Okay. So let's move on to another story now, anyway. And Martin, I want you on this one, because I've seen very little, if any, coverage of it in the national press at all. We had something yesterday in the House of Commons for the first time for, I think it's 140 years or something, a debate about how money's created. How is money created, and why is this such a milestone? And also, I suppose, three questions if I can ask you them all in one. Why is there so little reporting on this important debate?
Well, how is money created? John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous US economist, Canadian-born US economist, he said, the creation of money is so simple that it defies reality. It defies people's imagination, and they imagine that it should be really complicated, and it isn't really complicated. Effectively, the banks create it by creating deposit accounts, and which effectively is the money supply. So the illusion is that it's created by the government. The reality is that it's created by private bankers, and that's what this debate presumably was all about.
Okay, so having explained a little bit about that, what is it that the government should be doing? I mean, money, it's all about money, government. It's about all the resources they take from us and what they spend it on. We're seeing more and more of that money nationally, and it seems possibly locally, if this arena goes ahead, going on just repaying debt, which we don't want. We don't want our tax money to go to repaying people's debts for silly decisions that have been made in the past. We want it to go to help the vulnerable, for example. So what can be done in order for the government to take a little bit more power, more control here, rather than leaving it all in the hands of banks?
There was a senior member of the Bank of England, whose name now escapes me, who basically let the cat out of the bag about this a few months ago and said, well, actually, the economics textbooks suggest what's called the loanable funds theory. So in other words, banks take money in as deposits, and then they lend out loans. They can lend out loans as a multiple of their level of deposits. So the idea is fractional reserve banking is a certain proportion of the deposits will be kept back, and they can lend, you know, perhaps 10 times more, sometimes 20, 20, 30 times more than what they've actually got in the vaults.
But that's a biggie, isn't it? Because what you're essentially saying there is that when a bank is lending money at interest, it's made that money out of nowhere.
Well, no, the I think the reality...
Most of it, anyway.
No, the reality is the loanable funds theory, which is in the economics textbooks, is basically wrong, because the banks can basically make up any amount of money. And, of course, if you think about financial liberalisation over the last 30 years, if governments could control the money supply by raising the interest rate and raising the reserve ratio at one time, and in fact at one time they probably could, they certainly can't now. So, in other words, if you remember all the agonies we went through in the 1980s to get the money supply under control, well, we've handed it over to the international banking fraternity, and they now decide what the money supply is, and the government really doesn't have much of a say on it.
So why can't the Treasury just be creating money just like banks
well,
do?
Well, I mean, this is what Positive Money, the NGO that have pushed for this debate, are advocating, as is, groups in the US are pushing for similar ideas. And, of course, they're trying to change the thinking of all political parties. But I think there's a lot of mileage in this debate. The problem is that the existing system is actually shot to pieces, and reform is rather by the by once you've got to this situation. Cool. It's like a lot of green things. It's aspirational.
Yeah, but what you're saying is we can't do anything about it. I don't want to hear that.
No, from you,
what can we do?
Well, what we should have done when we bailed out the bank...
No, not what we should have done. What can we do now? There's never mind what we should have done a few years ago.
It's perfectly okay to debate reforming the system, but by the time we've got round to voting on it and decided this debate is not actually going to change anything, it's just a discussion, I'm afraid, as Cameron pointed out last week, the banks are going to collapse, and that will happen long before we've reformed them.
Well, you say that, but isn't it feasible, possible, for the Treasury just to simply do what the banks are doing and start to create money themselves, even if it's a small amount to start with, just to make sure that some basic services can continue?
Well, it may be, once you've had another crisis, that the Bank of England has, in fact, got a plan B to do exactly that. And I would, that's what, when you say what can be done about it, I presume the Bank of England, who are actually aware of the issues, are preparing a plan B for when this crisis hits. Let's hope so.
What are your thoughts about this debate and whether maybe it should have been covered a bit more in the news? I've had a quick scan around the internet. There's only like City AM have covered it, which is only a website, I think. I don't think that's even a newspaper. Just a little bit. I mean, it was Labour MP Michael Meacher, it says, argued there'd been too much money created by banks in previous decades helping to cause the financial crisis. So this is actually at the root of a lot of the problems that we're having to deal with here in Bristol with things like our 90 million cuts.
Yeah, I think that, and I've felt this for a long time, A, it's unimaginable to me to actually understand what on earth has happened and how it has happened, because I'm not an economist. However, from a layman's perspective, I look at it and think, Christ, we are right on the brink or the front or the doorstep of a black hole here. And we hear about quantitative easing, £750 billion. And when you put that alongside the actual budget that we have each year as a country, it towers over it. Well, where did that money go that went to the banks? Why couldn't that money actually be generated and put back into our economy, into our pockets, to actually keep everything going? I mean, I never understood why we couldn't actually give everybody money back to pay off all our loans to the banks and our mortgages to the banks, etc., which would then put the banks back in a zero position. I don't understand it. I have no answers to it. I find it frightening. I find it confusing. All I know is that I've been in debt ever since I was a student.
Well, I think that's right, and I think these questions are now being asked. And, of course, what happens is that there's an immense amount of inertia behind the existing setup and an enormous amount of political power. You bail the banks out, and then, of course, they use that money to carry on lobbying for further interventions on their behalf. And I don't think it would have been any difference if you'd had a Labour government at the last election. The pressures would have been exactly the same, and the desire to try and play safe, not to rot the boat, to go along with what the accepted wisdom was, would have been overwhelming. But unfortunately, of course, the years since the 2008 crash were the chances, the opportunities for whoever was in power to try and really shake the system up, and they haven't been taken. And I'm afraid we are going to go into, I believe that next year or the end of this year, we're going to have another serious crisis. And at that point, people really will start asking the questions.
Well, I think
there won't be anything else to do.
Yeah, I think it also exemplifies the fact that, you know, the free market works, but it only works for a handful of people at the top who are manipulating it. You know, but what controls and regulations do you bring in where we end up ultimately, living in a Soviet state where everything is controlled? I mean, we don't want to go that way.
That's a straw man. I mean, the real problem is that what the free market textbook said about things like RBS is let it go down. But we didn't do that. Mm. And it was George Bush who decided to rescue Lehman Brothers creditors. And at that point, you've actually, the free market philosophy ought to have been jettisoned at that point. If you are going to just bail out the financial system, that means that everything that happens after that point, the price discovery mechanism is gone. So in other words, we've made a political decision to bail out the banks. That's nothing to do with the free market. The free market policy would be to let them go down. And of course, there is a case to be made for doing that. But of course, basically, people looked over into that abyss and decided they didn't want to go there.
Well, it would only surely mean that people who were shareholders in those banks would lose out.
In theory, yes. And that's what the free market textbook says, that people shareholders would lose out. But
deposit protection, isn't there?
Yeah, but the problem is that this kind of crash is so disruptive of general economic activity that you may end up with a situation where you've got a total social meltdown, and capitalism can't function in a situation where you've got total social meltdown. We should never have got ourselves into this position. It's the deregulation of the financial markets in the 1980s, which is the fundamental cause. There were, for example, separating casino banks from retail banking, that was pushed through in the 1930s in the US to make sure that something like 1929 could never happen again.
And in the 1990s,
we stupidly said, oh, we don't need that anymore. And I think the evidence shows that we did need it, and we shouldn't have never have done it.
Yeah, ironically, the instability is what presents the opportunities for these new parties coming through and for, you know, the rise of people like UKIP who present themselves as alternative views. But, you know, they're all bankers as well.
Yes.
You know, and there's no other way around describing them.
Well, one person who was actually quite good on economics, who was around, I can remember him being around in the 1980s anyway, was Brian Gould. And I found a little chat by him on the internet, which I'd like to have a listen to now. One of the things he was saying was that actually it was one of the things that, that started us on this road was exchange controls. As soon as we let money flood easily in and out of Britain, it meant that the bankers and investors could hold the politicians over a barrel. So let's have a listen to maybe Martin, before we do, you could just tell us who Brian Gould was.
He used to be deputy leader of the Labour Party when Neil Kinnock was in charge, and he's from New Zealand, and originally he had been a British diplomat, but he approached John Smith and said, look, what we've got to do is we've got to basically regulate the City of London. John Smith said to him, no, what I'm going to do is what they call the prawn cocktail offensive. I'm going to be nice to the City of London and smooth their feathers. And at that point, Brian Gould, to his credit, said, well, I'm going back to New Zealand then. So that's what he's done. He's actually running Auckland University now in New Zealand. But he said, you know, the Labour Party in Britain just wasn't serious. And at that point, I just resigned and went
OK,
home.
Well, anyway, let's see what he said to inform our discussion here in Britain about what's wrong with our financial system. This is Brian Gould, former deputy leader of the Labour Party.
Governments were put on the back foot by the newfound freedom that those owning vast amounts of capital suddenly discovered when exchange controls were removed. They could use that money to go wherever they chose in the world. They could go to wherever labour costs were lowest, wherever the obligations of employment and health and safety matters, for example, were the least onerous. And they could simply say to any government, even the most powerful, unless you do what we want, we'll simply be up and off and take our capital and investment elsewhere, and you'll be the poorer for it. And so governments not only found themselves, however, against those realities, but they gave up a struggle that had been fought for centuries, in many respects, to try to defend the interests of ordinary people as against those of the very powerful people in world business. And a government like the UK government under New Labour actually celebrated the great achievements of the City of London. In the year 2007, as Gordon Brown left the Treasury and was about to become the UK Prime Minister, he said, future generations will look back on this era as having created and reshaped in a wonderful way the whole of the global economy. This will be seen as a golden era. And then a year later, of course, we had the global financial crisis. And I think the global financial crisis is in itself an instructive example, not only in the first place of how disastrous this free market approach has been, but also of how powerful those who benefit from it are in rewriting history. Because wherever you go in the world today, people will be inclined to say, oh yes, well, the global financial crisis, wasn't that more to do with governments overspending and that kind of thing? And yet it was governments that had almost voluntarily and willingly and enthusiastically in some cases that had stepped aside. And indeed our own government in New Zealand, if I may be partisan for a moment in the current situation, our own government in New Zealand continues to run our economy in the interests of business and pays very little attention to the interests of people who are struggling to make a living through working for that living.
Well, I think that's very interesting. I think he went back to New Zealand when the Labour Party decided to go in the direction that it decided to go in, and he still makes comments on British politics. And in actual fact, he was one of the people who tried to modernise the Labour Party in terms of changing the image and you know, get rid of the cloth caps and all that stuff. But he was very clear that the vision would be basically the goal of the British Labour movement should be to discipline the City of London. But they funked it. And, of course, he's not been part of it because he went away.
Well, what about one of the most interesting things he was saying there, which was their ability, through their immense wealth, to rewrite history?
Well, that's what's happened. I mean, even in the years since the crisis, it's all been rewritten as if it was overspending by governments that caused the crisis, when patently it wasn't. And just think of the way in which we're all arguing about how people on benefits should or shouldn't behave. Meanwhile, the people at the top of the pile who've been bailed out by the government. No, do you remember all the anger there was about that at the beginning? That's been smoothed away through PR in the intervening period.
Well, one of the interesting things I think was here the Prime Minister David Cameron in Australia, if we can go antipodean for a minute, at the G20 conference last weekend, actually echoing you, Martin, saying there's David Cameron warning a looming second global crash. Well, I don't think there was a global crash in 2008. It was a financial crisis where massive amounts of public money was put in to bail out these banks. It wasn't a crash, but what are your thoughts about David Cameron now sort of fessing up, I suppose, in the run-up to next year's election, Christian Martin, from the Lib Dems, to say, actually, it looks like there might be another crisis on the horizon?
I think, actually, to some extent, I find it difficult to accept that he's suggesting that there's a warning light flashing on the dashboard, which I think was his terminology, yeah. Specifically because, although a lot has been done to curb bankers' pay, and there's, you know, this week they dropped the opposition to the European Court's Parliament's curbing of bankers' bonuses, etc. But at the point at which the banks were at their most humble, they were on their knees, we didn't take advantage of doing anything about it. So when David Cameron tells us that we're all in this together, but, oh, by the way, there's a red warning light on the dashboard, I'm not sure that I necessarily would trust his judgment on that. I think he's right to some extent that we are in still a lot of trouble, but I'm not sure what the reason behind it is, other than the fact that clearly there is an election coming up and fear sells, as we've just found out in Rochester and Strood.
Martin, he's agreeing with you, David Cameron.
I think the reason he's saying it is because he will be getting advice from the serious people in the Bank of England and the Treasury that this is a definite possibility before next May. Now, if there is a global crash before next May, it might be, if it happens as a result of the popping of the British housing market, that will be very specific to Britain. But I suspect it's going to be something more general than that, like a run. You know, the Japanese economy is looking pretty ropey. That might be the thing that
Chinese as well.
Yes, okay, that's right.
Martin, from housing to mansion taxes, and we had a bizarre situation this week of Ed Miliband confronting some pop star I'd never heard of before. I mean, probably most people have, but I don't hear about these sorts of people. Mylene Klass was her name. So let's have a listen now to pop star Mylene Klass clashing with the leader of the opposition, Labour's Ed Miliband, on some ITV programme during the week. So, hear from our guests what they make of it.
The way that house prices are working in London, the people that are the super, super rich who are buying their houses for £140 million, this is not going to necessarily affect them because they've got their tax rebates and their amazing accountants. It's going to be the little grannies that have lived in those houses for years and years, and it's very, very kind of you guys to turn around and say, well, don't worry if you can't pay the tax now, we'll take it when you die, and the inheritance tax as well. It's going to be their sons and daughters who are then lumbered with this.
I mean, look, I totally
don't agree with it.
I think I get that impression. I understand that people don't like paying more in tax, but you said there was a window tax, Alison. Actually, there's something called the bedroom tax.
Well, I didn't work either.
On the poorest people in our society.
Nan lived in a council tax.
The values of my government are going to be different than the values of this government. I'll tell you how. I do think that the richest people in our society, we're talking about 100,000 homes, the top 0.5% of homes, we're going to uprate it in line with the rise in house prices for the homes above £2 million, so more people won't be dragged in. If you're somebody who's earning less than about £40,000, you'll be able to defer the payment until you sell the home. Until you sell the home. But look, I'm going to have to make really difficult decisions. Yeah. I understand you don't like it, but I'm going to have to make really difficult decisions about how we're going to fund our NHS, how we're going to make our society a fairer society, and I absolutely defend the...
Ed, how much are you actually going to make from this? Because you don't have a definitive number.
£1.2 billion.
Really? Because at the moment, some people are saying that there are 58,000 of these houses, 2 million and more, and some are saying there's 100,000. Some are saying you'll make £300,000 for the NHS, and some are saying you'll make £1.2 billion.
That was Moynihan Cass, the singer. I think she's a singer, musician of some sort, talking there to the leader of the opposition, Ed Miliband, on ITV earlier this week. Christian Martin, this mansion tax, I suppose it's two questions, isn't it? What do the Lib Dems think of the mansion tax? And secondly, what do you make of Ed Miliband's exchange there with the singer? And is it appropriate for a leader of the opposition to be clashing with some singer on the telly?
Well, I thought she was an underwear salesperson, isn't she? But, I mean, she's obviously... she certainly does, on the adverts I've seen, be selling some catalogue underwear or something. I think his performance was about as embarrassing as him eating a bacon sandwich. Didn't come across very well at all. As you know, the Liberal Democrats have always been in favour of a mansion tax. And I think that is right for us to look at the principle of actually taxing people more for... higher value properties. I mean, let's not forget all of the poll tax demonstrations in the 80s were based around the fact that people in much wealthier properties were paying considerably less proportionately than people in much smaller properties. And, you know, we have now this disparity where property prices have gone up and a lot of people have on paper and through asset acquisition and what have you become quite wealthy. And you know, there seems to be the need for a discussion and a principle around the idea of taxing them more as a consequence. I have this argument all the time with my father because he puts forward the same argument that Mylene did about, you know, little old grannies in houses that are they've seen accumulated wealth over the years as a consequence of house price rises. You know, maybe at the top, if we do tax, we can bring in some kind of corrective valuation on these properties and bring down property prices and create a downward spiral on the inflationary aspects of house prices.
What I don't understand is why we're taxing something that people need, a mansion. It may be a big house, but you need it. Why not tax something like, you know, your savings or something like that?
Well, actually, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the Lib Dems' position on mansion tax now is. Are you still in favour of it? Because you were and then you changed your minds, and then I don't know whether you still are in favour of it.
I think the interesting thing is ours always started at £1 million, and then the Labour introduced it and suggested they would go, or rather introduced the idea that they were going to put it up at £2 million. And then you look at the shadow front bench, you know, and all of them live in properties that are just below the £2 million threshold.
I mean, to be honest with you, it's the only fair point that Mylene Class made there is this is a relatively small amount of money, and it's a symbolic thing. What we could have tossed to is talk about abolishing council tax and moving towards going back. In Northern Ireland, they've still got the rates because, of course, they never managed to reform the rates in Northern Ireland because it would have caused a major multiple pile-up. And the rates, in fact, were a very sensible system because it really was based upon the value of the properties and it was uprated in line with the growth of...
Well, the other thing is it was paid by the owner of the property.
Indeed, it's paid by the owner of the property, not by the tenants and so on. So, I mean, going back to the 80s and the deregulation of the city, abolition of the rates was another ridiculous task.
William Waldegrave, by the way, just south of us here, was one of the people who...
We've had Tories on this programme who said that the abolition of the rates was a silly idea, and it was a silly idea. I mean, we've really got to go back to the 80s and see where we went wrong with all of these things. I mean, there wouldn't be this kind of fuss if the rating system was still the same as it was in Northern Ireland today and you'd carried on uprating it in line with inflation and so on. We wouldn't be arguing about putting what is essentially a stopgap measure tax on a certain class of housing to try and raise a bit of money for the health service.
Meanwhile, at the bottom of the pile, controversial benefit sanctions are driving more and more young people to homelessness. This is in The Independent on Wednesday. Chris Green writing, an increasing number of young people being made homeless after running into financial problems caused by the government's controversial welfare reforms. According to a report published today, a survey of more than 200 homelessness charities and council agencies across England uncovered clear signs the coalition's tougher regime on benefit sanctions is driving young people out of their homes. Reports of homelessness among under 25s who'd experienced benefit related problems have increased sixfold in the space of a year, from 1.7% to 10% in 2014. More than 90% of providers also reported the sanctions had affected young people's ability to access new accommodation. 2012, the DWP brought in tougher sanctions regime. Christian, this is the people who are our future, and many, many more of them. We're hearing four times more just in the space of a year now being made homeless.
Yes, it's alarming. I can't really express it any other way.
What do we do about it?
Ian Duncan Smith's reforms clearly aren't working.
Well, what do we do about it?
I'm not sure. I mean, we have to explore the reasons behind why the sanctions have actually impacted them so significantly and clearly reform them in order to ensure that we don't end up in this situation.
Well, the benefit sanctions basically mean that you just don't get any money. So then you're much more likely to be kicked out of your home. And this is happening to under 25s at an unprecedented rate, Martin.
Well, yes, I don't think they've thought through some of the aspects of the reform. Mm. I mean, one obvious point to make is that under universal credit, the idea, and private landlords have very much taken this on board, that the tenants will be paid the money directly and then they will pay their landlords, supposedly to encourage thriftiness and so on, social engineering. But the problem with that is that private landlords, there was a big buy-to-let landlord in the southeast, one of the biggest, said, well, in that case, we are not going to have anybody on benefits in our houses. And not only are we not going to take any new people, the existing tenants are going to be evicted. I want East Europeans who are all in work and will pay their rent. And that's a private decision. I recently had to transfer because I was short hold private tenancy, and I found it really difficult to find anybody who was prepared to rent to me because I was in receipt of some benefits. And that means automatically people can't get social housing, and they used to be relying on the private rented market, but now the private landlords won't touch people on benefits. Now that is an unintended effect of the government's reforms. And I think that they've been concentrating far too much on trying to, what you might, social engineering of the underclass, and less upon the practicalities of the realities. If you don't give people money, they've got to beg or steal. That's it. There's only two options.
It does seem to me that there's a deliberate attempt to create a kind of underclass, unpeople.
Well, I mean, the other point I'd make on this is, once you've pushed people around all the time, so they're moving along all the time and they never have anybody stable to live, those people don't register to vote. And that really does start to make them non-people in terms of the political system.
Another story this week, Britain's never-ending pay freeze. Wages have gone up just £1 a week. Wages have gone up £1 a week, sparking fears that the six-year-long pay freeze is not ending. This is in the Express. The pay rise to just £1 a week for Britain reveals 6-year freeze may not be over. The rise in the 12 months to April was the smallest growth in 17 years in wages. Christian, what are we going to do about this?
I don't really know the answer, is because it's an economic one, and you know, we have growth, but we seem to be stagnating when it comes
but
to
isn't the growth
when it comes to when
the growth
it comes to
is
wage
in the
growth.
Figures, isn't it? The growth is in the figures, right? The figures seem to be referring almost entirely to this casino economy of stocks and shares, valuations of businesses, asset values, this kind of thing, and it's not finding its way into the real world, Martin.
Well, that's obviously what I would say. That I think in the past there was a link between you expect productivity to rise in a capitalist economy because you've got new techniques, new technology coming along, and it usually rises at a range of about 3% a year, although at the moment it's stagnating per worker. But then what used to happen in the best managed countries like in Scandinavia is a large chunk of that was given back to the workers as increased wages. And in other words, you had a high wage, high productivity economy. That's the success of places like Norway. But if the workers don't actually participate in the growing wealth of the economy, and real wages in the United States haven't risen since 1973, think about that. 40-50 years of no real wage rises. Ultimately, the system doesn't work, because the system works best when you've got lots of people with lots of money to spend who go to Cribb's Causeway and spend it. And if they haven't got the money, then it all starts to gum up. And that, unfortunately, is where we've got ourselves. It's very good in the short run for the owners of assets. They can keep wages down, their profits are high, but they don't reinvest them because there's no demand in the economy. And it's not just the British economy, it's a global phenomenon.
Okay, we'll finish this week on the spy cables reveal. This is a Channel 4 exclusive by Paul Mason yesterday evening. It's cable and wires. They even went as far as providing traffic from a rival foreign communications company, handing information sent by millions of internet users worldwide over to the spies. Christian Martin, this is you're at Lib Dem on the City Council here. What we're hearing is that these big technology companies, in this case Cable and Wireless, which is now owned by Vodafone, are actually willingly cooperating with GCHQ. They are choosing between their customers and the spooks, and they're choosing the spooks, and they're hoping that the customers don't find out. That's essentially what Paul Mason's saying in this report last night.
Yeah, I saw the report on the Channel 4 News. It's one of those double-edged swords, isn't it? You know, we rely on our secret services to ensure the security of the country, and to that extent, they're looking at, you know, for terrorists and catching out terrorists. But, you know, them spying on me, I'm not sure. I'm an innocent party.
Martin, very briefly.
Well, there's an awful lot more spying going on than people realise, and ultimately they're going to lose money on this. I mean, the Brazilians are setting up their own internet to avoid exactly this.
OK, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks very much for this week's guest. That's Lib Dem Councillor for Clifton East, Chair of Place Scrutiny on the City Council, Christian Martin. After the Murdoch News, it's Lockerbie.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.